Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Have you ever asked yourself, what is your superpower?
Everyone has a superpower. Most people just don't know what it is.
We're going to help you uncover it.
This podcast is all about helping people figure out what their truly unique superpower is.
Superpowers, what's yours?
Hello and welcome to another Superpowers podcast. You know, everyone has strengths, everyone has weaknesses, but uncovering your unique superpower, it's like peeling back the onion to its core. We have a special guest here with us today. We are super excited. Chris, why don't you introduce our guest?
We got the rap sheet, everybody. We got Ian Rappaport, NFL Network. The rap sheet is in the house. It's been a hard time trying to track this man down with all things NFL and the draft, but we finally got him on the Superpowers podcast show. Ian, welcome.
It's good to be here. I've been waiting for this moment. It has finally come. Thank goodness. I will also say that if I have to text or take a phone call in the middle of this, I apologize, but only a little bit.
Yeah.
Listen, it would be awesome if you actually, because we told Ian if he needs to break, because there's, you know, the NFL schedule is being released today. If he needs to break, we'll edit it. But what he doesn't know is we're not actually editing it. So we're gonna actually get breaking news right here on Superpowers podcast.
And hopefully he forgets to hit the mute button. Ian, welcome to the show. So you know, as Bill already called out, we like to peel back the onion here. We want to learn a little bit about you and your journey, and hopefully Bill and I at the end of our show can do our best to tell you what your superpower is, because I know you've been dying to know that answer yourself. So we're gonna start that off. I'm actually gonna start a little differently, because I'm curious and I've never asked you before we get into your background. Rap sheet, where did it come from? How did that get coined, and when and how?
So I wish I could take credit for this, because it really is like it's a great name. I love it, and this is my third job at least using this moniker, and I will probably use it for the rest of my life. So I was in Alabama. I was covering University of Alabama, living in Tuscaloosa, but working for the Birmingham News. And one of the reasons that they hired me I was covering Mississippi State for the Jackson, Mississippi newspaper. One of the reasons was I started a blog covering Mississippi State. And at that point, blogs were very new, and fans seemed to like having timely information with all sorts of different stuff. And it's a little bit of personality, you know, that's different from the newspaper. Now it seems ridiculous and obvious, but then it seemed like a great idea. So finally, I would say a couple months after I got hired at Alabama, they were like, all right, we're now ready for you to start the blog. What should we call it? I'm like, well, it should be named something clever and interesting and catchy and, you know, about kind of maybe Alabama, since that's what I covered. They're like, how about Rap Sheet, since, you know, your name starts with rap? And I'm like, it's actually not bad. And we went back and forth about the actual name, because, you know, cover college football enough, you'll eventually cover some arrests and some things that aren't great, and would that be offensive? You know, we decided it'd be okay. So the blog was called Rap Sheet. And when I went to go cover the Patriots for the Boston Herald, I took the name with me, and that's kind of where we are.
And no trademark issues. So do you own the Rap Sheet, I guess, at this point?
Based on the sort of anecdotal discussions we've had, if anyone tried to take it back, because I've been using it so long, I would probably have claim to it. You guys would probably know better than I would. Thankfully, there's been really no issues. And I think I'm the most, like, sort of noteworthy rap sheet out there, aside from criminal rap sheets, I guess. So there's been no battling. Now, I haven't started to make, like, t-shirts or anything. No one's fought me on that. So if that ever happens, maybe we'll see if there's, like, a battle coming up.
It's a fair story. And when you mentioned Boston, Bill was cringing. Not that you're from there, Ian, but we've had a lot of our guests on our show in the last year and a half that are from Boston. So, Bill, you're welcome. Ian's not from Boston. You don't have to go into the Patriots small talk. But, Ian, so where are you from? Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your siblings, your parents. Give us a little sense of what childhood for little Ian looked like.
All right. So I grew up in Chappaqua, New York, you know, about 45 minutes or 50 minutes from the city. I grew up with both parents who actually still live there. My dad's a doctor. Mom's an educator. Is actually a doctor now. They're both doctors now, actually. And I have a younger brother who works in the city, and I have an older sister who also works in the city. She's a school teacher. And, you know, I would say it was like a fairly, for Westchester at least, fairly typical household, a lot of sports, a lot of making fun of each other. But, you know, a lot of sports and schoolwork is really what it was. So,
but it's not, it sounds like your family, both your parents and your siblings, took on the notable jobs and careers of saving lives and teaching. What happened to you? And when did that?
You know, I would say I went to Columbia after, obviously after high school, I went to private school in Tarrytown, a place called Hackley. And, you know, probably a year in, I started working for the Columbia Daily Spectator, like the student newspaper, and I knew I wanted to be a reporter then, like a newspaper reporter, which is really all I ever wanted to do. Mm. And my parents, you know, they were fine with it. I think they supported me, but I lived in their house for 2 years after college, making, you know, working part-time at the Journal News, making $12 an hour and no more, for 30 hours a week and no more. I'm not sure they were totally on board then. And I think the deal was after 2 years, if I hadn't advanced, then I would probably have to go like think about law school or something like that. Thankfully, like 2 years on the dot, I ended up getting a job in Mississippi, where I moved to go cover Mississippi State.
Where you made $9 an hour.
Where I made, you know how much I made? $33,000 a year.
Yeah.
And I was so rich.
Yeah. Well, and the cost of living in Mississippi has got to be a fraction of New York.
I mean, I think I paid $500 a month for my apartment, but the apartment was so big, it had two bedrooms, which at the time, again, was huge. So one bedroom where I slept in, the other bedroom was my office. And so started a long career of working very, very far away from where like my home office is. Like then it was in Jackson, but I lived in Starkville. Yep. When I lived in Alabama, I lived in Tuscaloosa, but the paper was in Birmingham. In Boston, I never went to the office. NFL Network's in LA. I live in New York. So, like, everyone's adjusting to the coronavirus life, working from home. And for me, I'm like, where have you guys been?
Yeah, Ian,
I do every day.
Ian, we talked about that a while back, not that long ago, a few weeks ago. And this is
although it seems like months in the coronavirus world.
It does. In Corona world, it's like a decade one day. But yeah, this is something that we're going to get into that you're very used to, the home office and the setup.
Ian, where do you fall in terms of you have a brother and sister? Where do you fall?
I'm the middle child.
You know what?
Oh, everyone's middle, Bill. Everyone.
Every single person from season two has been a middle child. There's got to be something there that we got to research. Very interesting. Very interesting. So you go to Columbia. Now, you know, Columbia is a pretty damn good school. And you knew you wanted to be a journalist. So you're headed towards a $30,000 salary no matter what. Bring us through that. Like, did you know you wanted to be a journalist when, you know, you were in college, or was it something you developed over the course of college?
So I went to college thinking I wanted to be a lawyer.
Got it.
And then
saved,
you know, not quite knowing what that meant, but it seemed like a good idea. And then, you know, I started writing. I always liked to write. And I was a history major. So I liked the storytelling and the writing of history. And, you know, I started working for the newspaper, saw my name in print a couple of times. People started to know me around campus. I liked that part of it.
Yep.
And I just liked the process of writing. And, you know, I would say probably by my sophomore year, I knew I was going to be a newspaper guy. And then I got an internship at ESPN after my junior year, working for ESPN Classic.
Ian, before we get to ESPN, was there anyone at that time when you were writing that you like, who was your inspiration, or who are people that you looked up to, that you admired from the outside? I said, man, one day I want to be like that guy or that gal.
I would say probably three people. One, Rick Riley. You know, I was a big Sports Illustrated guy. He had the back page then. He was at the heyday of just being like the, you know, journalism icon. I dreamt of writing on the back page of Sports Illustrated, not knowing how different the magazine world would be, but, you know, that was probably my dream. My favorite writer was Gary Smith, who worked for Sports Illustrated, wrote long form, just an incredible, you know, that unfortunately there's not a lot of that going on now. Just, you know, unbelievably beautiful writer. Just dig deep and get in people's souls during features, which I always liked. And then there was a Columbia graduate, Bob Klapisch, who is, you know, like a New York City tabloid writer, but covered baseball. I'm a huge baseball fan. And so I'm like, all right, if I could, you know, I'd love to be Rick Riley. If I couldn't, covering baseball for one of the New York City tabloids would be just the best. That's kind of what I wanted to do.
So Ian, did you play a lot of sports growing up? Like, did you play for your high school team?
Yeah, I played football. I wrestled for 4 years and I played baseball.
Nice.
And, you know, I would say I was pretty good. I played, tried out for the Columbia baseball team, played a semester and then didn't make it. Ended up as a lightweight rower for 4 years at Columbia, which was intense and insane. The team was good. I wasn't very good. The team was great. But it was just, you know, two practices a day, 6 a.m. and 4 p.m., just complete insanity. But, yeah, it was always – I always loved sports, but, like, I always tell when, like, journalists ask me, young writers especially, you know, like, I want to work in sports, I always say the same thing. You have to like the writing. You have to like the reporting or whatever it is, making documentaries, filming, whatever. You have to like that more than, like, sports.
Right.
Yeah. And also, like, you're going to sit watching games the whole time.
Right. And also probably the output of what a lot of people just see is like, hey, TV, and that's obviously sexy and attractive. And, you know, you get to meet some great people, but what you're saying is the core of it, which is the writing, the journalism, the storytelling, you have to fall in love with that. Do you find yourself doing a lot of mentoring and coaching with those that are kind of rising up the ranks that want your job?
Yeah, it's like, you know, same reason Tom Brady, like, you know, I mean, he'll help his backups, but mostly like, get to watch. Like,
you give them bad advice.
Don't be taking my job. You know, I try to. The problem is now is there's a lot of it. Like, people are, you know, sliding in my DMs on Instagram, you know, hi, I'm a college reporter. Like, I'd like some advice and I'd like to help everyone. The problem is I can't tell the difference between who's serious and who isn't, who will really do this or who just kind of wants to say to their friends. I don't know. So I will definitely, like, I'll help out journalism schools and I'll, you know, do like sort of journalism presentations and that kind of stuff and help the people I know. But it's just, it's hard to, I don't know. It's hard to weed through all the different people asking for stuff is kind of the weird best way to say it.
You know, I was thinking of it this morning, you know, when, you know, every young kid who loves sports, you know, always dreams of like taking that final shot, you know, of like making it. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get to a point where you realize like, hey, I'm not even the best kid on my little league team, you know, you know, probably not going to end up there. And everyone then I feel like, you know, goes to wanting to be involved with sports or cover sports, right? I mean, it's so interesting, and we're gonna get to that later. What I want to do is go back to, so now we know young Ian, we know you went to Columbia, we know you lived at your parents' house. They weren't necessarily thrilled that you decided to become a newspaper guy and stay in their house. They thought they were an empty nesters. No, they had little Ian come back. Then also, so is your next job down south? Bring us through kind of, I want to go through the rise.
So, I was covering mostly high school sports. I'd fill in and write like sidebars for Mets or Yankees, but for the Journal News, that wasn't my job. My job was to cover high school sports. You know, I covered a couple like high school football state championships. I was I'd go travel to Binghamton for the high school baseball state finals. Like, you know, great stuff, great trips. You got to be on an expense account, which was just bananas to me at the time. And I was doing really well, but I was still part-time. So there's basically like 12 part-time reporters and 3 full-time guys. Everyone kind of had the same job, but 3 people got paid for it. There was an opening at the Journal News. I was passed over for it. I cried like a baby. And when I had a meeting with the sports editor, Mark Leary, who's since passed away, and he basically was like, here's why you're not getting the job. And my first response was, I was looking at the company website, a Gannett newspaper website. Yeah. There was a job opening in Jackson, Mississippi to cover Mississippi State. I think I should leave. Would you help? And he was like, well, actually, you know, I happen to know the sports editor for the Clarion Ledger. He interned for me at USA Today like 20 years ago. If you'd really moved to Mississippi, I would happily make a call for you. Mm-hmm. Sure. I moved to Mississippi. So, but knowing that I had no experience covering the SEC, I barely knew the teams in the SEC, never been to Mississippi. So he called down. I applied. For some reason, they interviewed me, and I will never forget, you know, sitting in the living room of Rusty Hampton, the sports editor of the Clarion Ledger, and he was like, you know, why would you from New York or went to Columbia possibly come down to Mississippi to take a job like this?
Yeah.
And I was like, why would you hire me? Like, I don't have any experience and I don't know anything about the SEC. He's like, well, he's like, there might be something here. So he hired me. And so I left 24, single, drove down to Mississippi, moved into an apartment and spent 2 years there, you know, got paid big bucks. And the coach was Sylvester Croom, who was the first.
Ian, quick question. I went to school in Carolina. What was your first impression of the South? Obviously different parts of the South. I fell in love with sweet tea and grits and the Southern draw. And I was single then. So I can say that, that aspect and the sports culture right. And all that. What was kind of eye popping for you from your first impression of the South and the people there?
People were nice. You know, that was weird to me. Yeah. I was always New York City and I could be sort of abrupt at times and you'd be sitting there and I never had a problem like eating alone, for instance, or sitting alone. I don't really care. I still don't really care. So I'd go, you know, there's a bar like basically on the street called the Veranda. I'd go sit at the bar. I'd have dinner by myself. Just kind of hang out. And people would come talk. And I ended up becoming friends with a lot of like the really young, like support staff and football coaches just from like sitting at the bar because people would randomly talk to you. Now what's crazy is the people that like the really young assistants and support staff that I talked to were Freddie Kitchens. Who obviously was a Browns coach last year. Joe Judge was a special teamer, but he would go to the bar too, met him there. Amos Jones was on that staff. Shane Beamer, who's now at Oklahoma for Lincoln Riley, he was on that staff. I mean, it's just crazy.
What was the name of Ian, what was the name of the bar?
The Veranda.
Veranda. So all you need to do is DM all these guys on your IG and tell them to go to the Veranda and their career will skyrocket. That's just cut and paste the whole thing.
By the way, Chris, I love that you think like Carolina and Mississippi are, you know, on the same wavelength.
They're like 100 miles apart.
South, you know, like Mississippi is the South. You
know, I mean,
North Carolina is like.
I thought in South Carolina they drank unsweetened tea. Isn't that right or no?
Well, it's both. You can get your sweet tea and your unsweet. By the way, speaking at the bar, were you kind of bringing like, what was your drink of choice then? And when did you probably move over to bourbon where you had no choice coming into that part of the country?
I would say I would just drink beer then.
Yeah.
And so sit there just drinking beer. And I did try moonshine for the first time in that bar as well.
Oh, yeah.
Of course you did.
With a bunch of like coaches. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever had like legit moonshine, but it's almost like makes you instantly drunk. And I started to like sweat and they thought this was really fun. it's beer at that time had not quite gotten into the world of bourbon just yet.
So Ian, at any point you're in Mississippi, did you regret, you know, the decision, or were you just like over the moon because you're finally getting paid to do what you set out your passion?
Oh, I was good. I mean, I was, you know, it was very like lonely because I didn't really took a while, took like a solid year to like actually make some friends that I could hang out with. Yep. And then I met my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, you know, a year and a half into that. And I was only there for 2 years, but you know, it was pretty lonely, but just the ability to do the actual job I wanted to do and get paid for it and like travel. And I mean, it was,
there must have, there must have been some advantages to being lonely and not knowing everyone as far as focus and like kind of thinking about your career more obsessively rather than having a lot of distractions around you. I don't know.
Oh, 100%. I think about it all the time because, you know, at each point when I've taken a new job, it's been a little while, but, you know, when I got to Mississippi, I was by myself. So I literally just worked. That's it. I just worked and went to the bar. That's it. Played golf maybe. When I went to Alabama, I was dating Leah, now my wife, and she stayed in Starkville, only 90 miles away, but stayed in Starkville to finish college. So I had basically 3 months of like just doing work. When I went to Boston, Leah was finishing something for her work as a bank manager in Birmingham, actually. So I literally just had 3 months of starting like just to work. So that is like so important just to, when you get a new job, like all you have to do is just your
zero,
new job.
Zero in.
I'm sorry, Chris, Bill. But this is, ahead, this is, no, I feel like I have breaking news because, you know, what Ian just said was, you know, he went down to Mississippi. He worked, covered the SEC, went to the bar. But in the middle of all that, he picked up a college student and made her his wife. I mean, that's not bad.
Now, to be fair, I was only like 25 at the time, so it wasn't like totally crazy. But yeah, I would say that's true.
So now, how did you get the job at Alabama from Mississippi?
So I've been covering Mississippi State for, you know, at that point, almost 2 years. Yep. And there was a job opening for the Birmingham News to cover Alabama. You know, it's actually weird because thinking back, I didn't even want to apply because I was hoping in my like weird warped head that I would cover Mississippi State and then be good enough to get a job back up in New York. And that would be it. Cause that's all I want to do is get back to New York. And it doesn't really work like that. So
they force you to go to Boston first.
I mean, basically, yeah. So Leah, who at that point was kind of like we're just getting to know each other, but she was like, you have to apply for this job to cover Alabama. This is a massive job. Like, I know you don't think so, but you have to trust me. It is. And so I was like, all right.
Wow.
And I applied and there were 5 finalists. I was one. I was pretty sure that this guy, Josh Kendall, who covered, I think, Georgia for Macon, was getting it.
I can't believe you remember like everyone's.
Well, what's also incredible is we have Josh Kendall on right after you, so it's going to be amazing to cross reference his opinion.
He's
as
still
well.
Around. He's still.
We've never liked Josh, Ian. We've never liked Josh.
In all seriousness, Josh probably did me one of the biggest favors ever. I've never actually asked him about this, but this is what I was told. So all of these things are being followed on like these journalism message boards, like journalismjobs.com. So it was like this gossip circle. So everyone was like discussing who was getting what job, and everyone knew Josh Kendall was getting the Alabama job. And then for family reasons, he pulled out of the job and I got it. And I don't know if I would have got it or not. I have no idea. I've never asked him, but ended up getting it against like all odds. And so, you know, some of that was because of the blog I started, and they wanted to get really deep into that.
Ian, let me, I'm going to make you brag about yourself for a minute. At this stage, we all, regardless of your career path, everyone knows that they have, you know, an edge. I'm not going to use superpowers because that's too obvious. And we, you're not allowed to tell us ours, yours. We're going to tell it for you, as you know. But jokes aside, what is the edge that you believe that you have in your head? What is it that you're doing differently or you see differently that these other 4 candidates, and not that you know what the other 4 candidates, but I think you understand what I'm asking. Like, what is your approach to your path of coverage?
That's a good question. I mean, I would think a couple of things that just kind of come to mind. One is I work a lot and I like it. And whenever I talk to young reporters, I'm always like, if you like your job, don't be shy about it. Just tell people. People like to hire people who like to work. Why? Because you're going to be sitting in an office with them. And if they're in a good mood, it makes you in a good mood as well. I've always liked to work. I like reporting. I'm also like very, very open about how to do things. So like access is a big thing in journalism. And I never cared whether I would get access or not. Like, are the locker rooms open or not? Are the players media friendly or not? Because if they weren't, I would just find another way. And I think that's one thing that's really helped. So, you know, diving into like, what's a blog? Oh, I don't know, but let me start one and see how I can give people a ton of information. What's Twitter? I don't know. Like, let me just start it and that will help. Like all of these, I started doing videos at Alabama because I don't know, why not? People seem to like all these different ways to get at reporting. I was always really open to, and I was also young. So, you know, I didn't have a lot going on and I could just work a ton.
By the way, Ian, sorry, Bill, one comment. I just pulled up your Twitter. And for those, not that you need any more followers, at Rap Sheet. So you joined September 2008 and that's early. That's 12 years, right?
September 2008. So that would be after my second year, I believe, covering Alabama.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it's interesting because even if there were people with more experience who are much older, they probably didn't invest in creating a blog. Why would they? They had massive viewership elsewhere, right? They've been writing for years and years. So it's interesting that maybe, you got a job at an early age because you were kind of leaning forward and adopting technology. So that was kind of being young then was an advantage. Whereas now you got to have scale, you got to have followers, you got to, you know, it's much harder, I would say now. But maybe you benefited by that, you know, back then.
I thought about that and I was, you know, I'm not young anymore. I mean, I wear makeup so people think I'm young, but I'm not young anymore. But I was always, you know, at when I was covering Mississippi, youngest, covering Alabama. I mean, it was basically me at 26 and everyone else was like 40 or 50 because this was a, you know, covering Alabama is a job that you could have for the rest of your life. It's a great job. Yeah. And I was just always, same thing with covering the Patriots for the Herald. Like I was always, you know, youngest.
So you get the job at Alabama. Like does Nick Saban just like open the door for you? How do you create those relationships? Do you go to the bar? Do you find the next veranda?
Innisfree would be the Tuscaloosa bar. It was very different at Alabama. So when I got there, it was a good job. You know, you're covering Alabama for the Birmingham News is a good job. You know, they were okay. I covered a Independence Bowl my first year. They were fine, but still good job, a traditional power. And then Mike Shula gets fired and they bring on Nick Saban after a 38-day coaching search, which was like the biggest nightmare I've ever been a part of.
So Saban was not there when you
came out. Was not there. Yeah.
Very interesting.
So all of a sudden, everyone's reading everything I'm writing. And he and I battled very aggressively our first year together because, you know, there was discipline stuff and there was who was getting kicked off the team and recruiting and, you know, everyone was looking for everything to kind of pick at him. So teams were turning him in for recruiting violations and stuff. And I covered all of it and I sat in the front row. I always asked the first questions about it. And, you know, every time I called him Nick instead of coach, which on the message boards was a very big deal. So we battled for like a year. Second year, understanding.
Why didn't you? Because that's like not a Southern thing to do. Why would you call him Nick and not coach?
Because it's his name.
You know, so he probably thought,
people lost their minds.
This fucking New Yorker comes down south and doesn't give me the respect.
No, he didn't care. It was just the fan. That's what's crazy. He hated me for other reasons.
Right. Okay. And you're cool with us calling you Ian, right?
No. It is funny. What I get a kick out of is when people in sports do this a lot. They'll call someone coach who's not a coach. Like when Tom Coughlin's with the Jaguars, everyone called him coach. And I'm like, he hasn't coached for like 10 years. What are we doing? Whatever.
Ian, we're going to get back to makeup too. I want to, cause we have some ground to cover. So let's transition up to Boston.
By the way, I'm sorry, Chris, but The interesting part about this, and at every point in someone's career, even the most successful people, being at the right place at the right time, having a little bit of luck, never hurt anyone. I kind of feel like if Nick Saban was there and Alabama was the Alabama program under Saban, there wouldn't have been 5 applicants for that job. There'd be 50 applicants for that job.
Right place. Yeah.
I mean, there were a lot more than 5 applicants, just 55 finalists. But
okay, got it.
But still, though, you're right. I mean, I think about this all the time. It was a good job at the time, but to cover, getting one of those jobs now, for instance, as they've established like this national prominence, it's impossible. Everybody would want it. I don't know. And then you're right. Like getting the job when it was kind of like a sleeping giant. And then being there when it exploded, that helped me. And then you asked about the Boston thing. Basically, the way that happened was they posted a job, Boston Herald did, and they hadn't hired anyone from outside Boston in 20 years.
Huh.
They posted a job. You needed NFL experience, which obviously I didn't have any. And I wrote them this long letter detailing how I covered Nick Saban, with limited access.
Yep.
And how I would use that experience to cover Bill Belichick and the Patriots, also limited access. And I sent it away and literally thought nothing of it. And then they called me and were like, we'd like to interview. So they flew me from Baton Rouge, where I was covering a college basketball game, to Boston and then back home and interviewed, and then 4 months later, I somehow got the job.
Did you want to leave, or were you exploring? Meaning when you got the job, you're like, oh shit, Leah, we're leaving. Like, was it time to go?
No, I would say when we were in Alabama, it was awesome because we had a great group of friends. We had like a really good situation, really good setup. I was in a good place with Saban, with coverage. I was breaking a lot of stories. I was in a really good spot. And, the only reason I would leave would be for something very big.
Yeah.
Or if I could, get back to the East Coast for like a major job. And then
it was
this
time.
Came up and I applied and I literally thought there was zero chance
that
I would get it. And then somehow they hired me and I was like, we had to. And then, so like when the Birmingham News was going back and forth about like, we would offer you more money. I was like, don't. It's like, I have to take it. Just don't.
What's any good stories for Bill and I and our audience from your time down in the South, whether it was with the players or coaches, something that you haven't shared with anybody? Could have been just like the wrong moment, an embarrassing moment, something that you laugh about now or cringe about.
All right, I'll give you two good ones. One from, and I don't know if you guys will find this funny, but everybody else thought this was funny, in the South at least. So I was interviewing this guy, David Stewart, who ended up playing for Mississippi State. His nickname was Country because he was very country, very country. He ended up playing right tackle for the Titans for a long time. And he hated interviews, hated them. But I'm supposed to profile a different person each day for this like feature we're doing. And he finally agrees to let me talk to him. And he's like horrible. He barely says anything. I'm like, okay, fine. So I go find his offensive line coach and I ask him, I'm like, yeah, you just got done talking to Country. Like he barely said anything. He's like, and I'm like interviewing him. And he's like, all he cares about is hunting, fishing and frog kicking. I'm like, okay. So I think that's a funny line. So I write in the paper, hunting, fishing, and frog kicking. And I'm like, okay. I write it. It gets through. The next day, all over like the message boards, like, look what this Yankee reporter did. Because it's actually frog digging, which is you stand in the river and you try to like stab frogs with a little staff and you get them. But I'd never heard of that. So I thought it was frog kicking, where I guess you just kick frogs. Anyway. My Yankee inexperience there.
It's funny. Trust me, it's funny.
still, the fact that it got through the copy desk, still ridiculous. All right, and then the other one was, So I'm at SEC Media Days in 2009. And I had accepted the job to cover the Patriots. And I'm not really, I mean, I'm kind of working, but like, I'm not really working. I'm mostly just there to like have everyone tell me how great I am. Congratulations. And then to say goodbye to Saban. So, you know, I pull him aside. I'm like, hey, I want to talk to you. He's like, I heard you're leaving. You know, I guess congratulations, you know, and he said some other like kind of funny stuff. And I'm like, hey, look, you know, I know you and Belichick are close. If you wouldn't mind, if you could kind of like put in a good word, just tell him, you know, that I'm whatever you want, you know, that I'm fair. I'm a decent guy. Like,
that I'm a fraud kicker.
Yeah, basically. I think that would really help. And he goes, you want me to tell my best – to talk to my best friend in the world and fucking lie to him?
Like, oh.
Right.
That,
oh, there you go.
Clearly you had a relationship with him. Whether you know, sometimes your nemesis or, you know, your competitor, as we're watching The Last Dance right now, there's always you hate him, but there's a respect there. I don't know if that's what it was.
So I mean,
and now when Saban and I see each other, we're great, by the way.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's interesting, you know, and this is, you know, there are parallels to almost any industry and any career path, but, you know, it's interesting because some people say, hey, bet the jockey, not the horse. Right. And if you were to ask, you know, football, like avid football fans, like the two biggest personalities and people you'd want to cover in college and in pro, you know, and by the way, not the easiest to cover, but we'll get to Belichick, but you know, you got them both, right? I mean, it's Saban in college, it's Belichick in the NFL. Like, it's like, what, you know, if you got that job back in New York, you know, covering Eric Mangini and the Jets, you know, you probably wouldn't be the Ian Rappaport that you are today. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any other reporters who've covered Belichick and Saban. I mean, I've thought about it. I don't think there are, but both have been so different, so interesting, so hard to cover, and so rewarding when you do get something. So that's why, like, whenever, you know, like, whenever there's a hard subject or hard thing to get at, I'm kind of like, okay, like, I've seen all this before.
Right.
You know, like, it doesn't get any harder than trying to get information out of, you know, Alabama when Saban's in charge, you know?
So same thing, you know, how do you break through to Belichick, right? I mean, covering him, you know, I got to believe 4 out of 5 days, you're just banging your head against the wall. Cause he sometimes he just gives you nothing.
Yeah. And I never really minded that. Now, first of all, you know, there would always, I think me and Bill kind of came to an understanding pretty early that like, there was always questions out, and he's been there before. So it's not like I'm setting the flag on anything, but there's always questions I'm going to ask. He gets it. He'll either answer or he doesn't. And I never like went nuts trying to be like, why won't you tell me about this injury? You kind of ask, say whatever, yes or no, or something, or nothing. And then you kind of move on. So I always do my job. He'd do his job. But I think for him, you know, there were a couple things, that I think kind of helped me break through a little bit. One was, I was never shy about asking. So, you know, I was always like, I'd be like the guy at the bar who like talks to, you know, 20 different girls and doesn't care if he get turned down, right? I would request a lot of things. So we'd request one-on-ones with him for a bunch of different things. And sometimes he would say yes. So you go into a little room, you pull him aside for 5 minutes, you ask him about something sensitive or that maybe that you didn't want to discuss in front of other people. And he always got that because he knew that he was giving you something that others didn't have. So in those settings, he'd really be great. And I just don't think a lot of people asked because it's like, you're never going to get a one-on-one with Belichick or whatever. So we did that. And then the other thing was, you know, I went to a couple of his charity events and I was thinking I'd go and talk to him. But, you know, in the end, you know, you kind of sit, you watch him interact. He's doing good charity stuff. But then I asked to talk to him at the end of it and he kind of like blew me off. He's like, I'll get you another time. And I was like, okay. But then I never really wrote about it. And I think he appreciated me not publicizing the charity stuff. And he at one point called me and gave me an exclusive because he had said, like, I'll get you another time. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting, you know? And
you saw a pattern with dealing with him. I would think too, Ian, that your time with Alabama and Saban, he probably would have respected the fact that you were there. You obviously worked, you know, covered his friend. Did he ever ask you any questions as relates to the team or your time there or anything like that? Do you think that was pretty much one-on-one with Saban? Was the conversation always around the Patriots and the team and personnel, or did it ever expand beyond that?
Sometimes he would kind of ask about, like, you know, how they did this or that at Alabama. The problem with Belichick is he knows everything. So, yeah. Like, whenever, first of all, he can get to anyone. Anytime Belichick calls, whoever it is, you're answering.
Right.
So he always knew everything. And the other thing is Saban learned from him for a lot of it. So it's not like he needed to ask questions a lot. But it would come up from time to time. I mean, he would, you know, Belichick would always bring it up sometimes as a way to make fun of me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I imagine you probably had, when you hear Patriots players talk about him, he seems to have a pretty interesting and weird sense of humor. I'm not sure if you saw that side. Did you enjoy?
He's very funny.
Did you enjoy living in the Boston area, and where did you live?
Loved it. Still. Yeah. I mean, I like where we live now, but we lived in Southie and it was just the greatest. And it was, you know, it was not like, obviously, like old time South. He was kind of in the middle of the transition now to getting a lot younger and probably more expensive.
Yeah.
We lived on K and 8th down the street from L Street Tavern, which is still my favorite bar in the whole world, as, you know, publicized by Good Will Hunting, but really just a great bar. Yep. And, you know, a place now when we visit Boston now, we still go by that bar and still see some people we know, still bartenders are the same. We could not have loved Boston more. And I was good living there for a long time. Like I didn't seek to leave Boston. Like I was set. We were fine for a while.
And you keep saying we, and I know obviously this is Leah, but so she's up there with you. You guys are on this journey together. And I like that, how Bill asked that question, not only on the rise from the personal side, but also as we're with it on the personal, with your relationship. So you're obviously, you're doing this together. You're growing together. Is Leah working in Boston and she's got her career going?
She was a bank manager in Alabama, came up to Boston, didn't really want to do that. So she became a manager at Starbucks and then continued doing that when we moved to Dallas for NFL Network. And then, you know, when we had two boys, she eventually stepped down to barista and now is officially retired. But she was managing a Starbucks in Brookline, actually, when we were there, which was awesome.
Our nemesis. Yeah.
Hey, did you ever, so what did you call Belichick? Did you call him coach or you call him Bill?
Bill.
Nice. There's a pattern happening here. Now was there a time, right? Because the one thing I can tell, you know, being a New Yorker and other than football, I love all my New York teams. And, you know, like, and the huge rivalry between Boston and New York, like, was there any, you know, when you got there, people like, oh, look at this, you know, New Yorker covering Boston sports. Was there any of that?
No. I mean, I think they probably thought of me more as someone from Alabama anyway.
Yeah.
But what's weird is, like, you know, I grew up rooting for the Jets, but you do this enough and people are always like, oh, well, you know, you have to be unbiased. It doesn't really work like that. You just like become unbiased. Like you don't, I'm not like, oh, I can't root for this team. You just don't. It's just, my brain is wired differently. So like, I don't watch a game and root. I'm interested in what happens. And I like if the people I like, you know, won some games or didn't get fired, but it works so differently. Like I can't even remember having feelings when the Jets won. I'm still a Mets fan. That's what I root for.
Yeah.
Like you're so divorced from like emotionally being invested in a win or a loss that I can't even fathom what that was like.
You're too close to it. It makes sense that you'd root for your baseball team though. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah. Well, you know, with the Mets, there's not much to root for, but anyway,
that is true.
So, was there like a, something you really uncovered and broke with, you know, in Boston that, you know, that got your name at the national level?
You know,
or was it like just a series of things?
It's a good question. It's funny because, like, I can't remember. I remember all the things I got beat on. I can't remember specifically, like, really big stuff I broke, although I'm sure I did. I think what it was a lot was, you know, I had a blog, which I literally blogged 10 times a day, like literally 10 times a day. And in my off days, I would, you know, set the automatic blog function and I would write things. So it never stopped. So it was basically just like, I was like a nonstop fountain of Patriots information. And I had a lot of, you know, exclusives with players. I was really good at getting guys in the locker room who didn't talk to a lot of people. You know, I got Belichick a bunch. You know, I like, let's see, like Randy Moss one time on, you know, it was like June 2nd or something, whatever. I get a call from this guy who's like, hey, Ian, it's Donnie Blue. I'm like, hey, he goes, do you have time to speak to Randy Moss? And I'm like, I mean, yeah, I have time to speak to Randy Moss. And I just put ribs on the smoker. And so, you know, you put ribs on the smoker and you got, I was using a gas smoker at the time. So I had, you know, probably 7 hours. I'm like, yeah, I got time. So he's like, all right, Randy's going to call you. I'm like, okay. So then Randy Moss calls me, gives me this big exclusive about like a million things, which ended up being like a 2-day, you know, Herald front page, no one else got him. And so I interviewed him, transcribed, put up a blog post, took the ribs out, sauced them, wrapped them in foil, put them back, another blog post, wrote the story, sent it in, ate dinner.
Did you
that was a very high profile one.
You were obviously eating and cleaning your hands in between this. So one thing I just realized as you're telling this story, the speed of which you have to kind of execute from when you hear a story, and I've kind of, you know, witnessed to seeing you kind of do your art. I'm just kind of thinking about how your brain is wired in all these years of sort of writing, the ability to kind of hear information, dissect it, and then very quickly package it so somebody on the other end can unpack it, right? Like, I imagine a lot of this art and skill had come from, because you mentioned writing consistently through your, which I did not know through this conversation. But can you talk a little bit about that science of hearing something and how you, like, what you write and how you write it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really weird world. So, like, I will, you know, I'm going about my daily day and making phone calls, and you're hearing things, and, you know, whatever. But one of the weirdest things about my world is, everything could be normal, and then I'll get a phone call or I'll hear something and everything changes. And I've had to train myself to be like, okay, stop. Like, this is a thing. Don't do anything else. Figure this thing out. I had an example, you know, 2 weeks ago or whenever that was. So I'm making my pre-draft phone calls and, you know, I'm calling a million people from like 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. just on the phone all day long, hearing a million things. I take my notes, I report, some I don't, like, just, you know, a million things. And someone says to me, you're on this Gronk thing, right? I'm like, what do you mean? You know, the Gronk thing. I'm like, what Gronk thing? You know, he's probably going to go to the Bucks. Like, hold on, what are you talking about? And at first, like, yeah, I can't really say much more, but, you know, you probably should make some phone calls. So then it was like, okay, stop. Don't do anything else. Don't answer the phone. Do anything else. Figure this out. So I went from zero to breaking the Gronk story that he was going to the Bucks in about 6 minutes.
Ian,
three sources confirm in 6 minutes, and then tweeted it.
That was the question for our viewers: is what are you looking for? Like, you're calling sources that you're basically putting your life and the rap sheet name and NFL, your job on the line, that they're giving you the right information, right? Who are these people? And then is there a trifecta here, like triangulate, where, like, when you have three, you move forward, but if you hear it from one source, it's not
enough? Or is it two? You know, it used to be kind of two reliable sources, but you know, in this day and age, you know, anyone, if someone said, hey, are you covering this Gronk thing? Like, what do you think of it? You know, you can just get on Twitter and be like, hey, sources say, you know, so yeah, how do you triangulate that? You know, do you have to have at least two sources, or is it a judgment call?
Well, I would say, you know, hopefully you have two sources, but there's other times when you have just one source and it's the person, right?
Yeah.
So like, let's say my source is a player and he's like, just tore my ACL. Pretty good source.
Yeah.
You know, if it's the agent saying, I just got off the phone with my player, he tore his ACL, pretty good source, right? If it's, hey, this deal's getting done. Okay, well, let's say I get it from an agent. Usually that's good, but like, you just never know.
Yeah.
So then I would check with someone from a different side, team side, be like, all right, hey, I'm going to report this, just kind of running this by you, good to go.
And then Ian, how do you manage being first versus your friend, you know, Adam at ESPN or anyone else, right? Like, how do you think about this is a developing story versus this is the story, and also that kind of credibility piece, which leads me to my other question is, have you ever broken something incorrectly?
Yeah. So mainly it's like in my head, I got a lot of stuff, right? And there are some things where you haven't, you put it out right away. A player signing, okay, put it out right away, get the money later, but really just we want to break the signing. And then there's other stuff like, all right, I hear this person's name is up for trade discussions. Okay. And it's like, I wouldn't really report that. I don't know. That's not, it's news, but it's not that exciting. I'd like to break the bigger story, which is he got traded here. So like when DeForest Buckner got traded to the Colts, I knew about that for a month and a half. And I sat on it. I kept it quiet. I worked it from multiple sides. Ended up breaking it with the terms and him having a new contract because I held it for a month and a half and didn't say anything to anyone. So there's just different choices of like, you know, how you put things out. And like, you know, I was pretty confident that no one else had that and I was going to put it out. So like that you kind of save.
Yeah.
And then to answer your other question, the biggest story I ever broke was Alabama agreeing to terms with Rich Rodriguez. And it's true. His agent agreed to terms with Alabama. My sources were involved in the deal. I knew the years. I knew the terms. He had staff approval. The deal was done. And I broke it. Huge story. Scrolling on the bottom of SportsCenter. And then he changed his mind the next day after he met with his team. And he got a huge raise at West Virginia.
Yeah.
And I was like villain number one.
Yeah.
I've never been through any death threats. Like, I've never been through anything like that in my life.
Wow.
Everyone telling me my story was wrong. My sports editor went on Paul Feinbaum to support me and basically say the story is right. Like, it turned out to be wrong, but the story was right.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was crazy. You know, that was crazy. Pretty ugly, but it was also
it true. Can happen.
And sometimes the reporting actually changes what the news ends up being.
Right? Yeah. Hey, Ian, was there ever a time that you're on an intimate dinner with your wife, or like you have one of your boys' birthday, and like, you know, something breaks and like your job, you know, does everyone that you surround yourself with personally just understand at any given time you have to go and drop things and go do stuff?
Bill, let's get Leah in for this part. Ian, I'm telling you, she's a hoot, Bill. If she was in for this part, it would basically be the top-rated part of the whole show.
I will say, and I don't think I'm sharing any secrets here, she currently has – sorry, I'm declining a phone call as I talk to you guys. She currently has blue hair right now because it's quarantine and she had nothing else to do. So, so she would make quite an appearance here. The main thing is – hold on, let me respond to this text
to make sure.
No, it's breaking news.
I'll make
breaking
sure it's
news
not.
Here at the Superpowers podcast.
The main thing is, if it's real, everyone understands. Like, hey, I got to go. And if I say that, like, Leah and the boys, like, they know. They like, it's real and I got to go and it's urgent and I just have to. And you know, it's come at some very inopportune times. Now, a lot of times, like, you know, a lot of times I can step away, I can confirm something, I can tweet it, and maybe do like a phone interview if I'm out, and then be done and come back in like 8 or 9 minutes, you know, because TV segments aren't that long.
Yeah.
Whereas if I was a newspaper reporter, like go write a story, it's a little different, you know?
So Ian, you just teed this up. Share the story of I think one of your sons, I don't know if it was Jude or Max, perhaps joining your show without your, I don't know if you've seen this, Bill, but it's kind of, the main one was the CNN guy a couple of years ago, but you got to tell this one.
Yeah, this was a good one. So we had worked on Dez Bryant signing somewhere forever, literally forever.
Yeah.
And finally, we break it that he's signing with the Saints. Massive story. At this point, like he was, you know, this was big news. So it's like, we break it. Okay, need you on TV. Ran downstairs, put my makeup on, put my stuff on, jump in front of the camera. All right. Jude was homesick from school that day, so I'm in the basement now. He's right outside the door watching like a movie or something, lying down on the couch, like barely moving, sick. So Leah's sitting with him, and she says, Jude, stay here. I'm going to go make you lunch. Don't go in Daddy's office. And I just got a lock for the office that day, so we're fine. So then I'm literally on TV talking about Dez Bryant, and all you see is this. I'm like, the remote. I'm like, Jude? He goes, and it's just literally the remote. And so, and I'm like, because to him, an emergency was he couldn't figure out how to pause it. So, and at that point, we're literally like, I'm talking on the air. And I have two options. I could like kick him, which I really wasn't really going to do. Or I could just suck it up. And I pulled him, put him on my lap, and I continued talking. And I was ready to go. Everyone else lost their mind. So they were like cracking up like crazy. But I literally sat there talking with him on my lap, and he sees himself in the monitor because I have a return monitor. He's like making faces at himself, and he thinks this is the funniest thing. But I was like, now if I just locked the door like I'm supposed to do, it probably would have been okay. But
that's hysterical.
It comes with the territory, and I've seen some of your current colleagues. I think they really enjoy the banter is very real amongst you guys, and the teasing and the camaraderie. It's good.
So, Ian, how long are you covering? How long are you in New England? You know, covering Boston sports, and then how did you get the NFL job?
So I'm there for 3 years.
Okay.
And again, like I'm fine. Like I'm happy here. I started to do a little TV. You know, you make like 200, 300 bucks a night just doing a couple of TV stuff, like which is a lot of money. It was great. And then I'm at the Super Bowl. The second Patriots Giants, and I get a call from this guy who had kind of like, you know, arranged for me to do like a guest spot here or there for NFL Network. They had beat writers on at the time, just doing some stuff. So he's like, hey, would you mind meeting with a couple bosses? And I'm like, okay. Like, you know, he sends me where it's like going to this like conference room. I'm wearing like jeans and a sweater or something. I sit down at a table with these three bosses, and they're kind of like firing questions at me. And it goes on for an hour, and, you know, they're like, all right, well, we've talked to, you know, journalism questions and all these different things. And they're like, all right, well, do you have any questions for us? And I'm like, yeah, what am I doing here? I'm like, oh, well, we're thinking about hiring, you know, we're going to hire another TV reporter. You're one of the guys we're considering. I'm like, oh, well, I don't know anything about TV. And they said, that's okay. We'll teach you. And by the way, would you move to Dallas? And I was like, actually, like I had gone down the road with the Dallas Morning News to cover the Cowboys the year before. They ended up not opening up the job, but like I was pretty sure I was going to get it. Like they took us house hunting, me and Leah. Wow. So, like Leah took the trip with me. I was pretty sure I was going to get it, and they just never opened it up. I was like, actually, we almost moved to Dallas last year. So like, yeah, for the right job, sure. So I left the meeting. I called Leah, and I'm like, you're never going to believe this, but I think something's happening, and like, I don't know. Like, I think we might have to move. She's like, calm down. Like, they probably interview a lot of people, and they did. But I could tell, like, something was up. And so they called me a month later. They offered me a job, and it's like, okay, moved to Dallas. Was there for 3 years, but a year in.
Hey, Ian. One quick question about your interview process. Most people, I guess, I would do this when somebody asks you or says you don't, or you say rather than saying you don't have any TV experience, you know, there's more of this like, hey, I can do anything, I'll take it. You have this very honest, like, dude. And it's the second time I've heard this. Like, I'm not the right guy for the job. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, you're not winging it. Fake it till you make it. I mean, what's up?
Nah. It's just, I'd just rather be up front right off the bat, you know?
Right.
Also, it's true. And they're going to figure it out.
Right.
So I was like, yeah, I mean, there's been a bunch of jobs where I was hired thinking like, wow, I cannot believe they're actually hiring me. you know, and this was definitely one of them.
It seems like every job you started, like, I can't believe they're hiring me. You know?
That's true though, but that's pretty real. I mean, it's, you know, like when I went to cover the Patriots, like I didn't know anything about covering an NFL team, literally nothing. Went to NFL Network, knew nothing about TV working. I knew how to report, but yep. I didn't know how to work in TV at all. I mean, it's just, you know, crash course each way.
So when you first get to NFL, you're in Dallas. What's the first job? Do you go right on air? Did they send you to media training? Like, what do you do?
I went to LA for like 3 or 4 days of like training, just like how to hold a microphone and stuff like that, you know, but I was so far away from being like knowing how to do it. But then they kind of send you out and I was basically our Dallas bureau reporter. It's kind of like Ed Werder did for years, mm-hmm. but for NFL Network. And so they sent me to a bunch of different places to kind of get to figure it out. And I was really bad at the beginning. And, you know, I had one, like, particularly terrible time where I, like, completely forgot what I was supposed to say on air, just totally blanked. And then there was another one where I was in Minnesota, and I was just terrible. And, you know, when you're bad TV, it looks like you're reading.
Yeah.
It looks like you're trying to read on a teleprompter. It looks terrible. And that's what I looked like. And I remember thinking I was going to get fired. Did you
have a kind of a recovery plan or path, or do they help you with that when you're in that sort of moment of like, this isn't working?
I remember talking to my boss, and I was like, basically, like, I'm not getting any better. Like, I'm terrible, and it's obvious. You know, they stopped having me go live. You'd have to tape everything, which again is kind of awkward, but like, you know, I pride myself now on like literally any situation I could jump in front of the camera and talk, you know, but then it wasn't like that. So I was like, well, I need to practice. I'm like, if you really want to practice, you can go to the Cowboys facility. We have NFL Network has cameras in all the facilities, which we own, but you know, you see the backdrop behind everything. So they're like, there's a producer who's always in there during the overnight shift. He's doing nothing. You can just do fake hits to him and kind of work on stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I did that a bunch, spent an hour for like 3 or 4 times and just figured it out. And so the next thing I did was training camp in Charlotte, like to start the next season. And I got a call from one of my bosses that was like, I don't know what you did over the summer, but like that actually sounded decent.
The practice paid off. And on the question around makeup, how long did it take to get comfortable with it? And do you carry makeup in your back pocket, in your car? Do you have bags of makeup all over the house? Your makeup, Leah's makeup, whose makeup is it?
I have my makeup bag right here, little brown bag, or a little black
nice.
Bag.
Yep.
I use Mac and I use Sephora. I have a Mac Pro card, so they know me when I go in, you know. I never minded makeup. I didn't really care. It actually helps. So I put it on myself. I'm pretty good at it.
Yep. Training for that.
And what's really great is when you have to do it in public. So like you're around people you know or fans, you're standing there like in front of a crowd and you're just kind of like putting on your little makeup and whatever, just whatever, you know?
So Ian, you fumbled the ball a couple of times. You went back and you practiced. Your compliment was basically like, hey, you didn't suck on the training camp. When did you start becoming natural? And then, you know, did you see, as you were getting better and better, you know, on the camera, you know, did you just see your career and your brand just take off? Like, bring us through kind of that cycle.
Yeah, so I did a year covering the Cowboys, a season. And that season, I was fine. I was good. I would script everything at the beginning, and then I got better when I would just kind of keep bullet points in my head just to talk about. Because like everything else, I mean, you guys have given presentations, like, just talk, you know, like, don't write it. Just people have done it a million times. Stand up there and talk. It's very easy just to stand there and talk. So when I became, when I did that, it got much better. But late in the season, like December, my boss calls me and he's like, you know, I think we'd like to make you our insider. We didn't have one at that point after Jason Lockenpore got fired, or not renewed, I should say. And like, we'd like to make your insider. We'd like you to come to LA for Black Monday, which is what we called it at the time when the coaches get fired at the end of the season. Yep. You haven't broken one in 3 years. We'd like you to try to break one. I was like, okay.
Awesome.
So I went to, I did a lot of work. I went to LA. I broke the Bears firing Lovey Smith, which was a huge story at the time. And I was like, okay, like maybe I could do this. And then, you know, basically like a couple months later, they named me our insider, and that's, you know, moved to New York after I signed a new deal a couple years after that. But basically after that, it was like everything I did, like I went on the road for Thursday Night Football just to meet people for 2 years. Everything I did was about getting contacts around the league and like doing this job.
Ian, one quick question at that time, where was the NFL Network as far as ratings and sort of brand versus ESPN? Where is any context of the timeline from when you were there and where it is today? And yeah.
You know, I know that we didn't, at the time, we didn't break a lot of news. Now we break a lot of news.
Yeah.
At the time we didn't. Ratings, I'm not sure. I mean, okay. I know.
But it's grown.
It's grown. And I know for Sunday morning, we've closed the gap pretty good. I mean, we're in a really good place ratings wise, it seems. And I know from news, from a news standpoint, we definitely more than hold our own.
Now, when you became the insider, did you have to move to LA or did you stay in Dallas?
They talked about moving me to LA. I did not want to at all.
Yeah.
I didn't want to wake up at 4 a.m. every day and frantically check my phone just because of the time difference.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it was either move to LA and be in studio for game day morning, our pregame show, or move to New York and do it from 345 Park, the NFL office in New York City. So I chose to move to New York. So I finally got to go back to New York, which I wanted to go to.
And this whole cycle, what year, give us a timeline.
We moved to New York in 2013, I think. Wait, is that right? No. Must have been, 2015 we moved to New York.
And Ian, are you engaged, married, kid? Where are you in your cycle of your family as well at this stage?
So when we moved, both our boys were born, we got married in Birmingham. Right before I took the job covering the Patriots. When we moved to New York, we had two kids. We still have two kids. We had two small kids, both born in Dallas. Jude was like 5 or 6 months, and Max was about 2.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like 4.5 years ago, basically.
Right. Okay. Wow. Okay. So now we're going to get kind of caught up in real time. Couple, kind of final questions, but before we wrap. Wrap the show. You like that? Now you've come back to New York. Where and how did, when did you actually move out of the city into where you live now and sort of this setup, and talk to us a little bit about what you got going behind you?
Yeah, well, we moved to basically the suburbs like right off the bat. We just lived in a rental house and now a permanent house. But the thought was always, you know, move to Westchester and drive into the city every Sunday for game day morning. And, you know, they put a studio in my house, which, you know, everyone's always like, oh, it's so great. And it is great, believe me. But it also means you can be on air at literally any moment.
Yeah.
So my life is just different because, you know, I could be like in a swimming pool or something. It's like, hey, can you get on air? So, but still I can, you know, they put the studio behind me. It's awesome. We're on air like, you know, 10 times a day from here. And it's kind of been like that for the last 5 years.
Right. And I know, Ian, we were in the last couple of weeks, I wanted to get any insights of shifting gears on our shared experience and love for the Kentucky Derby. We miss it this year, back next year, maybe. No.
I mean, we, we're set to go in September. Hopefully it's on with fans. We'll see.
Yep.
The following year, I'm really bummed right now because it is currently scheduled for the last day of the draft and I'll be in Cleveland. So I'm, you know, working on the Kentucky Derby officials to move the race for me, but I don't know if that's going to happen. So I'm looking at the prospect of hopefully we go this year, but missing next year. And I will be extremely beyond bummed about that. Definitely one of the things I most look forward to all year. I'll say that.
Bill, you've heard me say this for years. You gotta join on one of these trips, man. It's one of the best.
You know, I acquired a company in Louisville, and after we acquired the business, around April, I get a note from one of the senior guys there, and they say, "Hey, what do you want to do with the tickets?" And I go, "Tickets for what?" And he goes, "The company has long-standing tickets to the Kentucky Derby every year. All the practice rounds and pre-ones, and then the actual Derby. The problem is my daughter's birthday is Cinco de Mayo, and it always falls like on her birthday weekend. So I've owned this company for like 10 years, and I've never been able to go. So
how old is your daughter?
Well, her birthday was 2 days ago, and she just turned 15.
Okay. Probably a decent age to go to the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah. Well, now it's moved. So now maybe I can actually go.
That's right. Yeah. There you go.
So now this is the silver linings. So listen, this has been incredible, right? Just kind of getting to know your history, your path. I think we can all agree your wife seems to be your superpower because she, told you to take jobs and, followed you wherever you went and, put your career first. And I think we can probably say that about almost every successful person, has a support yep. system behind them, but we're not going to let it off that easy. Chris, would you like me to start off and then you
Bill, let's stay consistent, my man. Let Ian hear it, and I'll give my take as well.
So Ian, I kind of just think out loud, throw some things out there, and then I give Chris time to actually come up with something intelligent. Listen, I think in this day and age, where you have access to millions of people either through Twitter or social media or now TikTok. See, people think it's so easy to kind of create a following. And the reality of it is it's not, right? And so, it's not like Ian, has millions of followers, just because he works at the NFL. It's like you have practiced this craft over a long period of time, right? So success just doesn't happen. And people may say, hey, Ian's an overnight success. And almost everyone who gets characterized as an overnight success, it took him like 20 years to get there. Uh-huh. What I would say is, you followed your passion, not necessarily the dollars, right? You got into this business knowing that it paid nothing. There was no Twitter back then. There was no kind of breaking news back then. Even cable, wasn't even as strong as it is today. So you got into this business because it was a passion. And what I would say is, sports, going into this, I thought, hey, you just were this like kid who loves sports and, love it. Sports was the secondary passion. The primary passion was actually publishing and reporting, right? And writing. And, and you practiced your craft. You got really lucky in that you practiced your craft with the best of the best, right? The best college football coach followed by the best professional NFL coach. But I think it's actually that kind of like, just passion around, that craft, it's all about time and place. And I said it before, bet on the jockey, not the horse, you also benefited by the fact that technology advancements, has risen to the point where you have a studio in your basement. You can break stuff, you can be on TV in a minute's notice. You can break stuff on social media. But what I would say is, it was that you just had like something inside you that was just like, hey, I'm going to do this. and I'm going to be happy doing it. And I could be paid $30,000 in Mississippi and feel like I'm the king of the world. And so you weren't driven by money. You were driven by that passion. And that passion was around reporting. It's not around sports. Sports would be the secondary piece of it.
So I'm gonna follow on to that. Obviously, touch on the fact that you were early centered around technology and adopting technology and blogs. A lot of things I picked up, Ian, on this conversation: high level of EQ, IQ, social awareness, social intelligence. I think your interactions with coaches, the charity experience with Bill Belichick, knowing kind of when to say what and how to say it. So I think that's definitely a layer of the superpower conversation, but I'm going to kind of try to, it's always really hard to synthesize, what it is. I'm going to go with I love Bill's summary. I'm also going to add a high degree of pattern recognition. Yes. I think if I had to really try to distill, and again, there's a lot of them, so don't be offended if you don't love it. But I think pattern recognition, all the data, all the inputs, all the experiences, conversations, locker room, all those different things, your superpower is your ability to see, take advantage of pattern recognition, and as a result of that, tell good stories.
The other thing I picked up, I picked up is you have this uncanny ability to remember every single person's name. Like, you recalled from, 20 years ago, someone who you were interviewing against, like, I cannot remember names. It's like my worst thing. So I like the EQ part of this, like the pattern recognition and EQ, but also following that passion. And I tell young people all the time, like, your goal is not to like figure out, hey, how can I make the most money? How can I do it? It's to find your passion in life. And if you find your passion, you're truly passionate about it, riches will come, maybe, and the riches may come monetarily, or it could be, come in that you just, you are at peace with life and you love life and you love what you do. But it seems like you have a 360 view there where you have you have that EQ, you're in the right place at the right time, but you followed your passion, and then you have people that support your passion. In Leah, who now I can't wait to have on the podcast.
So Ian, we built you up. You're going to feel really good about yourself as we let you go on your day. I do want to add one final thing before we let you go, and thank you. Outside of the professional side, I think talking about the father side and being a great dad and a great husband, I've had a little, some time to be able to experience that. I think that's a huge component of the family of life. So I want to compliment you on that, and obviously the great work you're doing. And we're gonna stop. We're gonna let you respond to text messages and get back to breaking news. Ian, thank you for all the time you gave us and joining the Superpowers podcast, man.
Awesome. It was a blast. It was everything I hoped it would be. And thank you for the synthesis of my superpowers. This has been great, guys. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Ian.
Superpowers.